Welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Jeffrey James about John Dee, Edward Kelly, the sorcerer, of course, and a lot of other things that connects with it, the Enochian magic, and I have so many more questions. It's just fascinating. I love talking about this stuff. It's interesting to see how this seems to be an initial point in a tradition, I guess, that starts out consequently, and a lot of other people are looking into this kind of work after that. There's some examples, of course, of how the Golden Dawn, try to bring this back. We also have Crowley. There's some other people as well. And of course, Jeffrey as well is doing a great job at going through the diaries and everything else. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about the hierarchy again of the angels and the archangels, and if there's anything that indicates that they managed to get in contact with the head honcho of the hierarchy, the big god, so to speak.
As the ceremonies continued, the quality of the communication, the things that they said, became increasingly more complex. It became increasingly more poetic and increasingly more powerful in a communications sense. And in terms of the writing, I mean, some of the stuff that they received towards the end, it reads almost like a Lovecraft novel, or like that's maybe, but not creepy like that, but mm-hmm. with the same sort of eldritch. You read, you say, wow, you read the material, stuff like the Enochian calls and the some of the communications that they had with an entity called the Daughter of Fortitude. It's very moving and frightening and awesome in the sense that it creates awe, and quite different from the stuff that's in the beginning, which is really a little more homey. Like in the beginning, the angel Medimi appears to them, and she's holding a doll and a book, and she says, this book has all these secrets you need, but it can't be opened to you now. And she has a little conversation with him. And it's almost quaint in a way. And then later on, there's these huge things happening, and there's almost a sense of desperation or of impending doom and breakthrough mm-hmm. that you feel as you read the material. And there's one critical portion where it wasn't, if I recall correctly, it was the point where the angels revealed that they were going to, that Dee and Kelly and their wives were going to have to practice sex magic to get to the next level, that Edward Kelly apparently had something akin to a heart attack. Dee goes over to him and says he had tremorum cordis, I think is the term, heart tremor. So he went over to him, the guy was like, he'd fallen over and, was having trouble breathing. And in that particular occasion, Dee records that the crystal ball that they were using lifted up off the table and floated out the window. And it was discovered later in a field. Now, everyone reading that, historians reading that, figure that, oh, it must have been a parlor trick. Must have been a magic trick. Because that's the only way you could explain the crystal ball going up and going in the window. Now, here's what's interesting about that. That would be a difficult trick to do using today's magical technology, like stage magic. That would be a tough one. Maybe I don't even imagine, and I do know a little bit about that subject, I don't even imagine how it could be done now. Mm-hmm. There is a book of stage magic was published right at that time, and the quality of what they knew how to do was so totally lame it was like stick a guy in a box and put his head out the box and put some stuff on it so it looks like his head was cut off. That's the kind of magic that they were, that was the sort of stage magic that was being done at the time. It was nothing with levitating crystal balls and making them fly out windows. So to make things even worse, if there was any person in the world who understood stage magic, it was John Dee. Because when he was in college, he had actually done stage effects so realistic that he created what everyone, this gigantic beetle that flew through the air with someone riding on it. And that followed him around the rest of his life. He was the guy that made the giant beetle fly. And he was considered, you know, evil because he had like done something. Hey, could only have done that with magic. So here we have world's greatest expert in stage magic of the period, the top expert, sitting there watching a levitation happen with a transparent object, which remember would be very hard. You know, strings aren't going to work with a transparent object. Think about it. And then it goes out the window. How are you going to do that? How are you going to do that? Not flew out the window, drifted out the window. How would you do that today? I have no idea. How could they have done it then? I have no idea. But Dee records it. This is what happened. And it was in his private diaries. This wasn't for public consumption. This was him recording what happened. And then after it happens, he goes over. Kelly's on the floor, essentially having a heart attack. This is a very interesting event. It's a very fascinating event and very difficult to explain. I'd say even almost impossible to explain using the stage magic technology of the time or even of today.
Let's talk about the description of our world or reality. There's a lot of interesting things that have been learned from this this work and what you know, maybe what it means to us to a certain extent, because it obviously offers a different version of reality than we're told. For example, you know, we have a world of 30 aethers, if that's the correct pronunciation of it. You have, you know, these are governed by different, you know, entities, if you will. You have something called the Watchtower, etc. It's a, it seems to be very, in a certain sense, complex, but a very kind of structured, orderly system of how things, you know, look, I guess, in our universe. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Some of that is actually taken from Ptolemy's geography. The way they're segmented, the way the entities are segmented, the 30 heirs, there's one that each area of the world has an angel who looks over it, who's responsible for it. And the only ones that are listed are the ones that fit into Ptolemy's geography. Therefore, in the system, there's no angel of North America or angel of Argentina, because it, even though the New World had been discovered at the time, it was not included in that way of looking at things, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
There's like almost no recognition that that happened.
Huh.
According to the system that was so laboriously recorded and annotated, there's a set of angels who look over, who are responsible for every part of the world and who are kind of take care of business and manifest God's will and watch over people and things of that variety. And the ability to call them is part of the, you can influence, I believe the theory was you could influence the politics of the region by calling that angel.
Right.
In the case of the, so that was one set of them, one set of angels. There was another set of angels that were connected with the seven planets, and in that case, it's the same thing as the any planetary concept. You know, you summon an angel of Mars if you're going to war, an angel of Venus if you're getting married, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so that's a little bit more typical. If I recall, the ones that dealt with the different parts of the world were also connected with the 12 tribes of Israel that had dispersed across the world. So there was also some tie-ins to the Old Testament and to many, many, many tie-ins to the Old Testament and how it was envisioned that the earth had been populated by the children of Adam and by the dispersion of the tribes of Israel after the destruction of the temple. So in some ways it reflects a medieval and early Renaissance worldview, and in some ways it reflects a an Old Testament worldview.
Does that, in your view, ultimately kind of strengthen the material, or does it weaken it? I mean, just what you mentioned there with North America, Argentina, and stuff like that.
So, I guess, it does either.
Yeah, not being part
either.
Of the.
Here's why. World. Here's why. Here's why it doesn't do either. Okay, let's start with the working premise that there are. Let's just start with the working premise. We don't even have to the premise that these angels exist. Let's just start with that as a premise. If they do, then they're communicating using the mind of a human being through the mind and making their mouth move. You cannot do, obviously, the limitations of the specific human being would be manifested in the communications of the of ad going through that person. Do you see what I mean? You're asking too much to ask that human mind to understand stuff that's beyond that human mind's understanding. So now it's going to be inflected. I mean, you know, it's going to be inflected in the language, in the background, and because that's the instrument that they're using. In the same sense that if you play Beethoven through a crappy little radio speaker, you're going to get, you know, you're not going to get the full reality of the experience. So, mm-hmm. if you take as the working premise that they exist, this is what they had to work with. They had the mind of Edward Kelly to work with, the brain of Edward Kelly, and the mouth of Edward Kelly, and the life experience of Edward Kelly, to with which to communicate what they wanted to communicate. And there's limitations to what they could do with that.
And these are not forces within us, archetypal energies, genetic memory, the collective unconscious, even let's say something like the Akashic record, whatever. There's a number of ideas out there of
well,
what could be.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. It's interesting that you say that, because if you take the concept of the collective unconscious to mean that in every human being there are representations of the same concepts, the Great Mother, take whatever archetypes you want, but if they exist in everybody, everywhere, regardless of culture, then they might as well be real as the physical world, because everyone is perceiving has the same experience, it exists, and it's kind of arbitrary to say that what you see in your mind is non-existent, but what you see with your eyes is existent. So there's some concepts in there. But yes, certainly that would be one explanation, that what we're seeing is a manifestation of collective unconscious or of genetic memory or something of that variety. Or you could look at the creation of the Enochian language as a spontaneous manifestation of the way the human brain creates language. And we know that since about 50,000 years ago, human beings have, whenever put in a group, will create a language, because we have some of the languages that date from back then. I mean, there's some survival languages, like in the Andaman Islands, and there was a language in Tasmania up until around 1910 that apparently was 30 or 40,000 years old. So human beings will create a language, and so maybe the human mind is capable of creating a language out of nothing instantaneously. There's been examples recently of languages evolving in isolated groups of people, cognate languages, where they take a piece, some of English, some of their traditional language, and some just made up words, and where an entire group of 30 or 40 people, usually young people, start talking this language. And it's not a pidgin language. It's not a patois, which is like a variation, a simplified version of something. It's actually a new language with its own new grammar and its own new syntax, and they're beginning to document this. So it may be that the human mind creates these things on their own, and what we're looking at in the case of Dean Kelly was the spontaneous creation of an artificial language or of a new language.
There are, of course, other paranormal events that you alluded to earlier that doesn't explain everything. There's other things in here that that makes the story, of course, much more interesting than that. But even if it was true, what you're mentioning now, I agree with you in the sense that it doesn't necessarily disqualify it as being, you know, not real or whatever. I think with our participation as human beings, with our mind and attention and focus, we are part of that creative process that makes things real. It's within the mind and even the collective mind that reality in a way is shaped. And maybe it's even, if we take that a step further, maybe that's even why some angels, kind of like just out of Greek mythology in a way, that the gods had to have our participation, that we had to know about them and worship them and give energy almost in a way for them to be alive, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Sometimes I think people obsess too much about what's real and what's not real when it comes to certain things. For example, it's my opinion of you can look at human love and affection and come up with an evolutionary reason for it and a genetic reason for it and a justification for it and all this stuff. But the experience of loving your children, that's not real. I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's real or not, you're experiencing it. Does it matter whether it's just stuff going on genetically? No, none of that matters because you're experiencing that. And I feel like it would be a great diminishment of anyone's life not to experience that. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing applies to the belief in the existence of God. It doesn't matter whether God exists or not. You're impoverishing your life if you don't feel the sense of love that that you're being cared for and that the universe is good. It doesn't matter whether it's a real experience or not. You're diminishing your life by not feeling that. In the same sense, you'd be diminishing your life if you sat around worrying all the time over, loving my kids is just a genetic thing, but or just just the evolution. It gives you no benefits to not just say, well, it's real because I'm experiencing it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. It certainly disconnects us from the experience as well, and it becomes too analytical instead of just being there and taking part of that process of.
And I understand why some people get that way about the existence of God, because it often is used because religion as opposed to those what we're talking about there, but religion is essentially a parasitical manifestation of something or other. And so the great harm has come from the world and from society as a general rule from organized religion. Some good things, but many bad things. And so people confuse the two and they figure, that the two are connected. But in fact, when we're talking about actual experience and we're talking about actual what people are seeing and feeling, which is why I try, you're thinking about something different, which is why I wrote Sorcerer the way I wrote it, because what you're seeing is the perception of people from their own viewpoint. So I don't have to get, you don't get into the argument, which is essentially a sterile one, do the angels really exist? Well, they sure existed to them because they saw them. They saw and their point of belief, this is what they saw and this is what they experienced. So by writing it in a very, very strict point of view allowed me then to investigate the experience of being involved in magic without sitting around and saying, yes, it's real, like in Harry Potter, or no, it's real like Joe Scientist. No, it's not real like Joe Scientist. I get out of that completely by writing about it. And here's what these people experienced, and here's how they saw what happened.
Even Jung had this approach, I think, to try to disqualify something is really not an issue. If it's being experienced, then it should be perceived as it is the real thing, because it is a component that affects us and changes us and gives us a different, you know, way of life. So even if it was, you know, to him, I guess, a UFO experience, or someone had a, you know, dream about something, it's all real because we're having the experience and it affects
exactly.
us.
And sometimes there's funny connections between the two. Arguably the greatest scientist of all time is arguably Nikola Tesla. And Tesla often had these, what he called like flashes of light, that he would like not be able to think, and he'd just see light, and then when he'd done, he'd all of a sudden think of a new invention. Now, does it add anything to say, well, he, you know, to point out, well, he was kind of nuts, which he was? Or does it just say, okay, that was his experience, and that was part of how he experienced the process of creating things, and what was the product of that? Inventions that we still use today.
Yeah, that's right. So it's real. He made it real. Whatever it was, whatever it came from.
It's sterile to speculate on the reality. On is it really real or not? It actually doesn't matter. From the perspective of, and I guarantee you, you know, and I'm sure you have, when you talk to people who have had profound religious or supernatural experiences, you can argue with them to the, you know, a day as long. Oh, that ain't real. But they know it's real because it happened to them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's right. And at the same time, then we want to try to know and understand and deconstruct it to, you know, we're human beings, we're inquisitive, we want to know, right?
Yeah, and there's also, I think, a need to, I don't know why people feel so obsessed by proving other people wrong, but that seems to be a really major human emotion. And
yeah,
so,
yeah.
So when someone has an experience like that, it's threatening to everyone around them. These experience was highly threatening to many, many people, particularly both churches, both the Protestant Church and the Catholic Church, thought what he was doing is unbelievably dangerous. What? You're getting a direct line to angels? What if they say something that disagrees with our doctrine? which, of course, they frequently did. And so they were constantly getting in trouble with the religious authorities, because they were setting up a system that would allow them to subvert the power structure of either church.
There is another aspect I wanted to ask you about a little bit. If you've heard about the 007 connection to John Dee.
You mean him as a spy?
Yeah, that too, but also even his kind of little sigil of the, you know, what looks like two circles and a seven kind of symbol and all that whole connection.
Oh, no, I don't know. I think that's coincidental, unless Ian Fleming picked that up or something. But no, yeah, I wasn't aware of that. I there was a book that I can't remember the 9/11 right now that postulated that Dee was, in his travels, was a secret agent and gathering information for Walsingham, who was Elizabeth's spy master. I don't think that was happening at this time, but I think if he saw anything interesting, he probably wrote him about it. He had a funny relationship with Walsingham, with this, and he was the go-to guy for cryptography, he was. And so he probably invented the codes or that they were using, the spies were using to communicate with each other. And he was the go-to guy if anything weird happened. Like when it was a comet, they wanted him to interpret it. When someone found a doll that looked like Elizabeth, kind of like a voodoo doll, they brought him in to say, okay, is there any danger from this? What do we do? And stuff like that. So he was kind of the go-to guy for anything weird that happened. He was also kind of like a consulting scientist for navigation and for shipbuilding, and for he also did cast horoscopes. And then that was actually a huge deal. Royal horoscopes were a huge deal because it was presumed, because a horoscope could be used as a justification for a change in leadership, or for an assassination, or for, you know, choosing, you know, to go for this monarch over that monarch, and when there was a contention for the throne. So it was actually illegal to cast horoscopes of royalty without having a specific charter to do so. And he got in trouble at one point for being found with a horoscope he wasn't supposed to have done, and was arrested. This was fairly early in his career, was arrested, and was in a pretty difficult situation, actually. He almost, he had a roommate while he was under arrest who was burned at the stake. So it was a pretty big stakes involved when he went off on this magic. It was not a small risk proposition to do this.
Hmm.
I mean, he was really putting his life, literally putting his life on the line, and to a certain extent, the life of his friends and family too. It was not a low risk proposition. It was not like, you know, opening an occult shop today and saying, okay, I can, you know, do crystal gazing for you. It was like, I'm going to risk, you know, being burnt to death alive, you know, to do this, to discover this. So it was not a small deal. It was a big deal.
Yeah. Why is it, do you think, then, that, I mean, obviously we have a Protestantism in England, or, you know, the battling of that back and forth at the time as well, around that era, but in other parts of the world under Roman rule, we had, you know, Galilei and some of these other people that were, you know, because of what they said or the science that they were into, they were being highly, you know, persecuted and threatened, if you will. But you're kind of alluding to, you know, John Dee had similar issues as well to deal with, I guess, right?
Worse, much more dangerous.
Much worse, huh?
Much more dangerous, because the angels would say stuff like, the Pope is a heretic. You know, and this is not well received. And he had the character who I turned into, who I kind of combined characters to create a villain, was Malaspina, a guy named Malaspina. I just love that name. And he was a papal legate who was sent to investigate John Dee, and interviewed him at the court of the Holy Roman Emperor. And Edward Kelly said all the stuff that the angels had been saying, and said, you know, the Pope's a heretic, you know, the church, and Malaspina, which we have a reference, I think a letter that he sent, he said, I felt like throwing the guy out the window, he said. Which is interesting, because it was in the palace in Prague, when there's a famous event that happened there called the Defenestration of Prague, where a number of people were killed by being thrown out the window. Evidently, that was the windows are pretty high. I've been there. The windows are pretty high, and the fall would be pretty steep.
Interesting.
I worked that into the novel.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's interesting. So there are a lot of these, you know, tidbits, obviously, in there, as you said, and historical events that are weaved into it as well. That makes it even the more interesting, of course. What does Enochian magic, if we kind of stick to the Christianity thing and Catholicism and everything else, what does Enochian magic has to do with Christianity and Judaism, if anything? Does this religion come out of the basis of previous experiences of, you know, Christian and Judaic saints, if you will, or whatever you want to call them, those who wrote it and those who had the experiences?
Right. It certainly proceeds out of a biblical worldview. I would say it related more to the Old Testament than the New Testament. But when you look at things like the Enochian calls, they fall into the area of apocalyptic writing, you know, predicting the end of the world and how it will happen. And as such, it doesn't specifically mention the Antichrist. It doesn't specifically mention the scenes or items from the book of Revelation, but it is the same kind of thing, the same kind of prediction. And it's you kind of get the impression that if all these were activated, the world would end. Yeah, so it's kind of, and there's so it fits into that kind of realm of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's not certainly a deep thought of himself as a Christian. I believe more specifically, I think he was associated with more with Catholicism and his personal beliefs than he was with certainly than with Anabaptists or the radical Protestant sects. I think he was probably quite comfortable with the Church of England, which was really just Catholicism without the Pope. I think he was pretty comfortable with all that. When it came to the wife swapping, they the four of them signed a contract, which makes it extremely interesting reading, I think, where they promised not to tell anybody and promised if any of them tell that the other three will kill the person who tells. Or not, maybe not. Maybe they just said that, you know, that they, you know, that God will kill them or something like that. But, and that's has Christian elements in it in terms of the contract that they wrote, and they're trying to resolve what they're doing in the context of their belief system was sometimes forced them to be a little kind of convoluted in their thinking.
Has anyone picked up this work, Enochian magic, the evocations and everything in any serious capacity, as far as you know? I mean, we have Golden Dawn, as I mentioned before, MacGregor Mathers kind of reigniting the idea a little bit in the 1800s. We had Crowley, Anton LaVey has been in there a little bit. There's some other people. Is it, I don't know how to put it, but is it active in any regard today?
Oh yeah. There's plenty been published on the practical practice of it. Probably the foremost writer on the subject would be Lon Milo Duquette.
Yeah, we've had him on. Yeah.
Yeah, Lon, who a wonderful man. Wonderful man. He actually set me up to with Weiser to get Enochian evocation back in print. So I'm grateful to him for that, and he's been very encouraging to my writing of the novel. So yeah, there's quite a bit of that going on. Quite a bit published on the subject.
And do you believe that is it on the same level of efficiency as when John Dee and Edward was into it?
I think that if I were to sit back from it, I'd say that Enochian Evocation, which was published in the mid-80s, has been a fairly influential book because it sort of reestablished, here's what the system of magic he was using, as opposed to the Golden Dawn interpretation of the magic, which was a different approach. It was the Golden Dawn was an attempt to resolve all those issues with kind of a cult Freemasonry, and they also took an approach of there are some inconsistencies in some of the tables and the way that the angels are spelled out by little sigils being laid over tables that go letter, 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 forming a little squiggle. And some of the squiggles don't match right. And so what they did in the Golden Dawn, for example, they had in where they do these magical tables, they put stick like four letters into one table because that's where all, in order to solve the problem that some of the angels' names didn't match. I took the opposite approach. I said, okay, they had these two tables as the names, and there were inconsistencies, and you'll find them if you look for them. And I did not attempt to resolve the inconsistencies. I said, okay, this is what they wrote down. And so I think that I was instrumental in having people who were involved in or interested in the practical end of it try to reestablish the way that Dee and Kelly had practiced it as opposed to the more of the Victorian methods. That being said, I know that there's, there are active Golden Dawn organizations who are actively practicing the system as devised by Crowley and Mathers based upon their interpretation of the material.
Do you think that anyone that does the work can contact the angels? I mean, does this mean that we have maybe people today who are actively guided by the angels, and to either they do their bidding, if you will, whatever the consequence of that is, for good or for bad, or in some other capacity, try to take advantage of you know, what they have to offer the angels?
I think that would be up to the individual's experience. And what I know that there is one, I was talking about this with a friend of mine recently, there's a fairly famous writer, although I can't think who it is, but right now, off the top of my head, who does an Enochian operation before every book, and he credits it with making them into bestsellers.
Hmm. Interesting. And I guess I'm as well thinking, Jeffrey, on a kind of on a bigger scale, and because I'm curious to see. Well, I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of the potential tricksters as well on the other side, if there are different levels on it, and if there are different angels that you know, might not have our best interests at heart. Maybe there is demons in there that are posing like angels, or a number of different scenarios that might arise. And today we have people who are influenced, if you will, by these beings, and therefore, might sound overtly paranoid, but why not contemplate it, right? But we might have the world is heading into a certain direction because it's being guided indirectly, if you see what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know if it's that. I don't know if it's necessarily helpful to overlay that onto what's going on. I think things are screwed up enough on their own without.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, if I were really this to stand back on, I'd be worried a lot less about angels influencing things and more about the way that the internet is metastasizing radical thought. So I look at, you remember, as someone who watches the business world and the technology world pretty carefully, and mm-hmm. there's scary stuff. The stuff about the NSA and
sure.
tracking everything that people do, and and the easy way which radical groups can recruit people for kind of wacky stuff, and the way that the level of argument that happens online, there's kind of as convenient as the internet is, I believe that it's kind of that there's a certain element of it which is cancerous to society. And it's going to be a wild ride. I don't know whether, you know, if you want to attribute it to the, you know, manifestation of demons, that's as good an explanation as any, but it is not. I think things are probably scary enough without having to add a supernatural element onto them.
Right, right. Well, I've heard, you know, some previous researchers have been talking about the development of technology through the extension of the of our scientific knowledge, and that this was something that early on in the process was, you know, shared by other entities. In other words, we've been helped along, if you will. So in the extension, and again, this is more indirectly, of course, that one of the consequences of this is our technology is, you know, just what the things you mentioned, basically. And again, it doesn't mean that I want to put all the responsibility over on something else instead of what's inherent in humans, but it could be a partnership there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose so. It's I mean, you could speculate that you know, there's been for the past 50 years, there's been every decade there's a prediction that the singularity will happen.
Right.
You know, a machine that can think, and it's always 20 years in the future. And
yeah,
20 years pass, and it's 20 years in the future, and it's always restated as 20 years in the future.
That's right.
And now they're looking at things on, you know, the same sort of thing, but one could postulate that what's missing is some supernatural element that would actually provide some motivation beyond just the ability to think.
That's right, yeah.
So that certainly, I think, would be good material for a genre novel. You know, someone conjures the Enochian spirit into, you know, the NSA computer and creates a singularity. But
yeah, it's pretty wild stuff, huh? Yeah, creating. Like,
yeah, it would be. I guess what I understand is that I'm not particularly fond of looking at supernatural. I personally don't look for supernatural explanations for technological developments.
Although,
I said, you could make a case that these angels predicted all the stuff that was going to happen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. So do you, or have you practiced Enochian magic yourself?
Not recently.
Not recently. Have to do it to get another bestseller.
I think you have to put everything in the context. I'm a pretty serious guy. I have a pretty serious career as a business writer, and that's primarily what interests me now. When I was in college, it was the hippie era, and there was plenty of everyone was doing strange stuff, and so I have my share of strange experiences from that period.
Yeah. Well, it's been very interesting, this discussion here. I really appreciated, your time here today and talking about your work and your books. Is there anything else, out of the books that you'd like to bring up, or something you'd like to leave us with on the note, something maybe we forgot, or kind of a more important roundup as opposed to where we were heading right at the end here? What do you think?
No, I think that if you have an interest in the subject matter and what it is really like to practice this kind of magic, The Book Sorcerer, a novel of Queen Elizabeth Alchemist, which is the full title, that really encapsulates what the experience is like. And you talk to people who are involved in it, like Lon Milo Duquette, or Polk Runyon, and people like that who are actually very into the practice of this, they will tell you this book is accurate. This book is what it's like. So I don't think there's any other novel like it.
Let me ask you one more thing before we let you go. Do you think that it's the case that people have exclusivity to the angels in terms of their work of how to do it, or do you think does it work on a different level, that you, let's say, you can have actually multiple people at the same time kind of contacting the same angels, the same entities, because it doesn't work in the way that we're, like, you're talking with a human being. It doesn't work in the same way. What do you think?
I think it's unlikely that it would be exclusive. I don't think you can look at it like it's like a telephone call.
Dialing to God, yeah.
Yeah, it's not like that. It would have to be more the sort of experience that, would be universal rather than specific.
All right. Very good, Jeffrey. Let's round things up here again then by giving out your website.
Sorcerer.net. Yeah. Or you can find it on Amazon or the iBookstore. The novel is Sorcerer, a novel of Queen Elizabeth's Alchemist.
That's right. We're going to have that linked up on the website. And then, of course, following on from that, you have the Enochian Evocation of John Dee.
Still in print. Still in print. From Wiser. And you can also order that from, there's also a link for that on sorcerer.net. That's easily found and on Amazon too.
Very good. Well, thank you, Jeffrey. Really appreciated this. We will have to stay in contact. And anything new coming up for you? You're going to continue work? Do you have other plans in this kind of same category plan for the future?
Actually, there's been some inquiries on film TV rights for the novel. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Ah, interesting. Well, good luck with that. Love to see it come onto the picture, the screen in some way. Yeah,
definitely a long shot, but it's fun thinking about.
Very good. We'll leave on that note. Thanks again, Jeffrey.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, we are always happy that you're interested in asking the bigger questions, thinking and using both your imagination and your critical ability. We'll carry on with Adrian Silbucci next on Red Ice Radio for an update from Argentina. Then Lisa Arbaceski is coming back to Radio 314 with Lana for what I think is going to be another great program. Graham Hancock on The War on Consciousness, Ken Rolla, Scott Onstott, Suzanne Posel, and David Icke are some of our other upcoming guests. I hope you have a great start to your week and that you're staying cool and focused, interested and aware, but a healthy distance to the things that seek to drag you in and drag you down. We believe in information, but also to uplift ourselves and our spirits in the process as we work to understand the world and ourselves and learn to enjoy the process as well. On behalf of Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and John, we say thank you so much for listening, for your membership, and for your support.